The following interview is with Ralph Raines of Cherry Grove. The conversations cover a wide variety of topics. He talks about his father, Waldo Raines, starting a couple of early sawmills in the Forest Grove area. From there, he goes on to tell about his experiences in the woods, logging, sawmilling, and tree farming. The tapes provide a taste of the nature and the humor of the men of the woods.
Is there some way I can, if I'd like to think for a minute, some way I can shut that thing off your tape for you?
Just switch it off there. First, I would just like to ask you a few questions about your personal self as far as where you were born and your age and your birthplace.
Well, I thought maybe I was thinking about this, and I thought maybe I'd come to that after I maybe spend a brief resume on the folks here.
Okay, why don't we start that way from the very beginning of the Rain family then?
Well, as far back as I know, some of the Raines, I think they're some kind of a great-great-uncle. He's a great-great-uncle of mine, a person by the name of Lawrence Raines and Mary Raines. Were like the Great Migration West, and this was at a time when Horace Greeley was a great newspaper man, and he was shouting about all the riches in the West and so forth, and firing up people's imaginations, for which was a great influence on the migration West. And it was like, you know, the old adage, go West, young man. Well, he was right about that, but it's a hard life too, and many people return back to the East because they couldn't stand the gap out here. It was too rough. But my people come and they stop for some reason. They must have had a bad set of scenes back there, back east, or conditions or something. Or either that or they didn't know any better. And Lawrence and Mary Raines are buried in Dodge City on the right side of the tracks. And that's as far west as they made it, but then anyhow, there was two brothers by the name of Harvey, and the other brother I don't know. They were coming west, and this is a story that's handed down to me by the family. And the two brothers decided to split. They were in the last of the westward migration, and the new Oregon Trail was newly opened up, and of course the Santa Fe Trail was an older trail. One brother chose to go the Santa Fe Trail and the other brother chose to come the Oregon Trail. And Harvey Raines come the Oregon Trail, and that's my grandfather. And the other brother, he went through the Santa Fe Trail, and he stopped off in Texas, and there are quite a bunch of Raineses down in Texas, and we're all related, but I don't know any of them. Some of the more famous ones that I know only from seeing them on movies and so forth is Ella Raines and Claude Raines. Ella Raines, I've never met her, I don't know her.
They were movie actors?
Yeah. And the Raines that took the Santa Fe Trail, he stopped off in Texas, and he got into trouble down there. He got caught stealing horses by one of the local ranchers and some of his cowboys, and they had a little west of the Pecos justice down there, some Judge Roy Bean justice down there, and promptly hung him to an oak tree. So, but anyhow, he got his stem winder into something down there long enough to get the Raines started. And Harvey Raines, he was more a law-abiding citizen, and he took out a DLC and acquired property in a little Indian town in what is now the state of Idaho, a little small Indian town by the name of Weipe. And I'm not sure how it's spelled. I think it's W-I-E-P-E or double P-E. I'm not sure about it, but it's up the Clearwater River out of Lewiston. And there he married a breed Indian girl off the local reservation, and I guess that makes me about something like a 1/8 Indian or something like that. However, I don't show any of it, and my dad, the picture on the wall right there, he shows Indian, and he was swarthy, but he was an oddball quarter breed. He was a blue-eyed Indian, blue-eyed quarter breed, which is very unusual. But anyway, I'm all bleached out and white as far as practical purposes is concerned. But anyhow, he married a girl there by the name of Susan. His maiden name was Marshall. Susan Marshall. And they proved up on their plane there, and then they eventually, I think it was around the turn of the century sometime in there, sometime between there and 1910 or something like that, where they come on by wagon and horse and wagon into Portland. Boys left, there was three brothers in the family and one sister. Oscar Raines was the oldest one, and then Roy Raines, and then Waller Raines, my father. That was my father. Boys left home at a much earlier age then, a level of education was about the ninth grade, what they call or junior high school now, I guess you'd call it. My father had a ninth grade education, but he left home at age 14, worked in the shingle mill in Index, Washington. I think it was a Great Falls Shingle Company. I have a picture of him here someplace. At age 16 with a bowler on, sitting with his shingle crew. And eventually he'd come on down to Portland. And by this time, his brother, Oscar, the oldest brother, was already out here in this country and had a mill at Gales Creek. My dad joined him there. That was around 1914, something like that, 1915. And they sawmilled there. And of course, those days, transportation and logging was very difficult. And systems of logging were not developed as to where you could transport logs very far to the sawmill. So you always moved the mill. In those days, you moved the mill to where the timber was. Well, they'd log out a circle all around the mill, and then they'd move the mill. Well, it was decided by the brothers that they would move from Gales Creek to the Scoggins Valley area. And they set up a mill. They moved the mill by team and wagon, and my mother was a part of that. She was a Portland girl, and she stemmed from a family that come from Kentucky and Missouri. Her father, my grandpa Grabiel was their name, was a good German name, Grandpa Grabiel. He was quite an educated man, a circuit rider around Broadhead, Kentucky. Established a town back there, Grabiel. I don't know whether that's in Kentucky or Missouri, but someplace there. And that town of Grabiel is still in existence today, I understand. But he come west, and they were wheat farmers around Ione Heppner country, and some of my relatives, secondhand relatives that still are still there, I've met them and acquainted with them. But anyhow, she was a Portland girl, and quite a religious family. My father, and her name was Idus Grabiel, IDUS. When they were first married, she helped move that mill with a horse and team to Scoggins Junction. The war with World War I was on at that time, and the United States entry into the war was imminent. So then 1917 come, the government told the two brothers that one of them could stay and run the mill, but one of them would have to go in the draft. So it was decided, my brother being the youngest, that he would go in the draft, and his older brother, Oscar, would run the mill. And after the war was over and my dad returned, they went into partners together, then moved the mill to Laurel.
What was involved in moving the mill?
Horse and wagon was involved in moving the mill. And it was nothing more than a few wheels and they didn't have bandsaws for head rigs in those days. They were all circular, and it wasn't too bad a job to move the mill, but it was all done with team and wagon. And they moved the mill into Laurel from Skowhegan Valley Junction, and they sawmilled up there for a while, but then they got a contract, tie-cutting contract, with Southern Pacific Railroad, and so they moved the mill back over to their up to Laurel, when they were located there, they leased the property from the Sam Coberstein family. The Coberstein still live in Gaston. Descendants. Sam Coberstein only died here a few years ago. He was in his 70s. And they moved the mill in back to Skowhegan Valley Junction, and that was located, the mill was located then on the Deathless people property. And Harvey Deathless is a few years older than I am. He's about approximately about 60 now, 59 or 60, and he's a real estate salesman in Forest Grove. For what the heck's the name of that? For Heisler Realty there, I believe it is, something like that in Forest Grove. There, he's a descendant of the Deathless people, and they leased that property at Skowhegan Valley Junction from the Deathless people. And then the third brother, Roy, joined them at that time, and Roy worked in the mill. Oscar took care of the older brother. Took care of the sales. And my dad did the logging, and he logged that ridge just south of Skowhegan's Creek, between the old TV highway now and Stimson Lumber Company. He logged all that ridge in there with a pair of perching horses, a team of perching horses. And and then came 1920, June the 15th, and I was born, folks had a tent and sidewalls there. Dan had a 16 by 16 military squat tent, and he had that over a tent and sidewalls. And my mother tells about that when she used to sweep the floor, that by the time she got to the door, that there was no dirt left to pick up, because it all went through the cracks, and the whole thing was built out of green lumber to start with, and when it dried, why then it all shrunk up, and there were cracks in the floors. And my first year I put in the winter of 1920 there as a baby, and she says there was never a day that I didn't have the colic, and I don't know how in the hell I ever survived, but survived people did somehow another. Infant mortality rate and was high in those days.
And people that worked in the mills with your father also live in conditions like that, houses like that?
Oh yeah. And I think it was the spring of 1921, in the very early spring, why Dad decided he wanted to go off sawmilling on his own and try it. No bad brother blood between the brothers, because they always cooperated and looked out for each other. And Dad went to the community of Carnation, south of Forest Grove, and he bought property there. That was an incorporated community. And a little history of the community of Carnation was that prior to or around about 1917 or 18, Carnation Milk Company had property there and a milk condenser, and which was a common thing, as milk companies had collecting points all over the country in those days, because there was not refrigeration. There was only icing, not refrigeration. So they had to have a lot of collecting points, because most of the milk was brought in by the farmer himself in horse and wagon. So they had these little collecting points all over. And then they run the milk through, process the milk through the condenser and iced it down and so forth. So Carnation Milk Company had property there and a condenser and a collecting point. And it was an incorporated community. Carnation Milk Company also built what was called then Colonial Hotel. It was a hotel there primarily for the housing of their employees. But also they took in the public at the same time. And as we know why the railroad went south of Hillsborough, the Southern Pacific went south of Hillsborough and Forest Grove, because what was it, Mr. Hill, I think, or what, got into a big argument, and he had a big mad on at the two towns, and he was going to show them who was going to be have the last word, so he didn't take the railroad through their towns. And so the railroad went through the community of Carnation. And there was a depot there, and I can show you right where the depot was. And they built the hotel, they had the milk condenser, but they took in the general public too, traveling through the country. Lots of salesmen stopped there for overnight, and as a sort of a way station and so forth. And my dad bought property from C.L. Bump, who lived in Newburgh. I don't remember whether he was a lawyer or a doctor, but then there was Dan Bump, also lived in Forest Grove, his brother, and he was a lawyer. And in the 1920s, why, Dan Bump, and grew up into the 30s until the time he retired even. Dan Bump took care of a lot of the legal work for my father, just general law work. And he bought property from the Bumps there, and then there was a general merchandise store, and the post office was in the same store, right exactly where the what is now Willamette Industries retail office, right exactly, just right in the back of the building there is where the post office was. I'll show you where the exact location was. I know exactly where it is. It was also a livery stable, where you could rent horse and team. There was livery stables all over the country, because when you went any place, a lot of times you went on the train, or and then when you got there, well, you either rented a saddle horse or you rented a buggy. And there was a livery stable there, and the Bathillier people owned that. They had the general store, the post office, and the livery stable. And and eventually, as transportation road systems in Oregon and transportation got better, and cars began to come in and were more mechanically sound, and people understood a little more about how to run the things and how to change tires and a few things like that. Why, of course, these little milk condensers and milk collecting points all over the country began to vanish. And so did Carnation. Carnation, the community, incorporated community of Carnation, diminished then. My father then, with the mill there, which he had some Carnation, he owned some of the property, and he leased some property for his mill site from Southern Pacific. He sawmilled then from about 1921 until about 1929. And he decided that he needed a more modern mill, so he tore that mill down, destructed it, and it was a dry yard, what we had a dry yard mill. That means that they just dumped the logs off of the railroad car right out on the dirt, and then they just yarded them all around with a horse, a team of horses, bucked them into mill links, whatever they wanted, and the horses, they'd pull them in the dray yard over, and then they hook cable on them and pull them up log chute into the mill. And I have pictures of that here, and darn it, I can't. I'm still trying to locate those two pictures I'm telling you about, but anyway. He destructed that mill, and he built a new modern mill. It's one of the very most modern mills in the country here. And he got it finished, and of course, insurance in those days, insurance companies, their cost of insurance on mills was very high because of the hazard. But they didn't know how to insure mills. And mill owners then didn't know how to build mills that were safe, relatively safe from fire. And mills weren't all too clean, and they collected dust and so forth like that. Very explosive dust. And my dad finished that mill. Building the new mill there in 1929, the spring of 1929, and started to run it. And of course, things were recovering from the recession after World War I, and gee, was doing pretty good. And he had that, he paid for that mill, had it paid for it 6 months after he started it up and was running it.
How big of an operation was the old mill that he had going? Were a lot of people employed there at that time?
I don't remember what its capacity was, maybe 20,000 feet a day, 20,000 board feet a day, something like that, 20, 25,000. But the new mill, its capacity was double that, and about double that, is 30, 35,000, but it's a very modern mill, most up to date for that time. And he was about a, he had something short of $100,000 investment in total property and capital investment, total property and mill construction, and but he only had about $8,000 worth of insurance on the thing. And on August the 21st at 9 p.m. 1929, that mill caught on fire. And as the newspaper clippings, which you've seen here the other day when you were here, caught on fire, and $30,000 of that capital investment went right up in smoke, and it totally demolished that mill. And all he had was $8,000 worth of insurance. And I don't have to tell you what was it they called a Black October hit. That stock market plummeted, the world depression was on, and boy, I want to tell you, we were poor, ragged. And I just don't understand the strength of my dad to, in the face of all this, to go across the tracks south of the Southern Pacific Main Line there, south, and buy the Carnation, the remaining part of the Carnation property. He bought that and the condenser, went through the old condenser building, revamped it with timbers to make it structurally acceptable for sawmilling, and he built a sawmill that was bigger than the one that burned down. And he finally got it to going. I think it was in late 1931 or in early 32. And the depression was, I don't have to tell the older people, the depression was full on her back. And people were the bread lines and the soup lines and the educated people, good people, walking up and down the tracks with packs on their backs looking for anything so that they could send a nickel or a dime or anything back to their family someplace, wherever they may be. And men, it was, things were so tough and so desperate that men gave up. And they just drifted off from their families, and because they couldn't support them anyway. There was no work. Dad used to have as high as 10 and 25 of these kind of people at every night in the winter time. He'd let them sleep in the sawdust bin next to the boiler in the mill so that they could stay warm and keep from freezing to death.
And the rest of the economy was in such dire straits. Was there much of demand for timber?
Very weak because no one had any money, and I don't have to tell you what happened to housing. There was just nothing being built. People were living in shacks, they were living in tents, they were living any place they could find. The banks were loaded with properties and foreclosures from mortgages that couldn't be honored until they were land poor and bankrupt. And then FDR come in what year, 1933 or something, was it 34 or something like that, we had the presidential election. First thing he did was close the banks down for some few days until they could recoup. And then he started the NRA, which turned out later to be unconstitutional, but at least FDR served a purpose, even though later on he became quite unpopular with many, many people, but nonetheless, his first 4 years in office, he served a real purpose because he had some fine ideas about at least whether it was right or wrong. At least it got the country moving again and began to bring the thing out of its doldrums, and things were so bad that it took almost a decade to start getting things back to where people could live and not want to commit suicide and jump out of windows and everything else and desert families. And things were so bad that many families just broke up in desperation. There's just no other way. And so anyway, I know Dad had a terrible time trying to pay for that sawmill. He owed Portland Machinery Company and he owed Star Machinery Company until he felt that he just couldn't stand it any longer. He couldn't make it any longer. And I remember him saying, well, I just got to go to Portland and tell him to come and get her, that I can't make it no more. But they didn't want the machinery. They had machinery sitting all over the yard down there in Portland. They told him to go back and try it, and he did. And by God, pretty soon he began to come out of it. And he paid them off, and he made some money. But the many tough years,
was he the exception? Were the rest of the mills around the area, did they go bankrupt and collapse?
Oh, God. There was only about two mills in the country that were able to stay with it, besides Carnation Lumber Company, my dad's company, and that was Longview Lumber Company, which is now International Pulp and Paper, and Crown Zellerbach and Weyerhaeuser. There were several little mills around the corner, you know, but sawing a few boards to sell to the farmers here and the farmers down the line someplace or something like that, but they only run spasmodic. They were intermittent mills. And they might run a few days if they had something, some farmer wanted a few boards or something like that, but they weren't sawmills which produced a continuing payroll. In this area right here...
Excuse me for a moment, Mike.